Business Lunch. Hi, this is Sean Williams. Pete Zimmerman's the producer, and we're glad you tuned in. We'll be here until 1 o'clock. Anna DeVlantis after that with more news and entertainment. Let's entertain you with a little business news now, and we start with John Najarian to talk about how the markets are doing. And another boring day, John. Things continue to go pretty well, at least on the stocks, right?
Yep, that's very true. In fact, we have been picking up speed throughout the session today, speed to the upside. The previous four sessions, it's more or less been a slow bleed to the downside. Today, it's pretty much straight up.
I kind of wonder what the fundamentals on all of these are. Is the market overpriced? I mean, it's so reactionary these days. I wonder where it should be.
Well, it gets debated a lot in trading circles, not just over at your radio station. And I think if it were not for the Fed, in particular, keeping rates and throwing rates down to negative in terms of real return, I think the market would be substantially lower. But as we always say, you trade the market you have, not the one you want. And this is the market we have right now. And it's, for the most part, if you're in the market, you're pretty happy.
Do you support the Fed policy these days?
I do. And I'm a broken record, of course, but you and I have talked forever ad nauseum about wishing that the Congress would have supported as well, and I think they would have made the Fed's job easier had they done that. But it's been since July 31st that they have not had additional payments to people except through some manipulation for the Social Security with being withheld or not withheld, and some people, a very small percentage, getting some of that money that way, $300 or $400, not nearly the same as the $600 they were getting before. And for the most part, the people we're talking about, Don, are the people that need it the most, restaurants that are shut down and so forth.
Tesla sure made a lot of news this week as it goes into the, what is it, S&P 500? Is that what's happened? Or no, they're a Dow company, aren't they?
S&P 500.
S&P.
Not a Dow.
Yeah.
Yep. And yes, they have. And it's one of the hot sectors. You know, you just look around at any of the EVs, electric vehicles, and you see similar sorts of just massive money flows and limited amount of shares that they can buy. And in the case of Tesla, it's a seller's strike, meaning that people that already own it have not wanted to sell into the inclusion, and for that reason, it just makes it harder for the people trying to get in and the indexers who must get in. If they're duplicating an S&P 500 fund, they pretty much have to have Tesla in there because it's such a big part.
That car company's going to stay. You know, sometimes somebody comes up with a novel idea, and then it fades, either the technology or the styling or the company itself. Do you think Tesla and their kinds of cars are going to remain players, or are the maybe big three or four going to just sort of eat up that market and they will not remain a player?
Because of their technology in the battery space, I think they will be the force, the, you know, capital T-H-E, force to be reckoned with when people want to see how the data plays out. In all manner of driving, Tesla has millions and millions of miles on those cars, all of which speak basically to Tesla via wireless transmit through the internet. And GM, General Motors, Mercedes-Benz, BMW, they do not have even a thimbleful of data compared to Tesla. So yes, battery technology continues to favor them, as well as ways to make those batteries last longer and run better within the vehicle.
Maybe next time we talk, I'll ask you, what is your prediction for 2021 about the markets, about the economy in general? I asked our Orion Samuelson the other day where he thinks the Dow will be, at the end of next year, based on where it is now and whatever he's got in his crystal ball. Orion's pick, as I recall, was 30,800. 30,800 on the Dow. So essentially flat year to year, which I would kind of take, to be honest with you. I don't know what you, do you have a gut reaction to that?
My gut reaction would be a little higher than that. We're at 30,200 roughly right now. So we're 600 points from his, and I'm certainly not going to joust with Orion Samuelson. That guy's been around a long time, knows a lot about markets and investor psychology. But my view would be a little over 31,500 would be right around where I think we settle in next year.
All right. I'll let you think about that more. We'll talk along these lines next week. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
John,
take care, John.
You betcha, sir. John Najarian, founder of MarketRebellion.com. Wintrust Business Lunch continues on WGN. Greg McBride is with BankRate.com. He's the chief financial analyst there. Welcome back, Greg. Nice to have you on the show today.
Good afternoon, John. Thanks for having me.
Two-fifths of households say their income has not recovered from the initial coronavirus hit. In your mind, is that the glass is half full or half empty?
That's, to me, half empty, because I think it illustrates, you know, just how widespread the need is, you know, as if 19 million Americans drawing some form of unemployment compensation isn't bad enough. You got tens of millions more that are working. They're back to work, but they're making less than they were before. Maybe the two-income household is now a one-income household. They've had hours cut. They can't operate a business as normal. So there's just a big shortfall for tens of millions of households that's not addressed through unemployment compensation.
Yeah. Makes one wonder what a recovery, quote-unquote, really means. That is it the employment rate or is it the income level of those households?
Yeah, well, it's the income that pays the bills. And so, yeah, it's one thing to say people are back to work, but if you're working 20 hours a week and, you know, business is a fraction of what it was this time a year ago, you know, that's, you know, that leaves just a big hole to fill. And you know, we see that there's softness in consumer spending on credit card and debit card transactions relative to what we saw a year ago during the holiday season. So I think that illustrates the fact that there's either the ability to spend is crimped or the willingness to do so. That was another thing we found is the vast majority of households are worried, even if their income hasn't gone down yet, they're worried what might happen in the months ahead. And that type of concern, it also causes people to hold back.
Is it still the K-shape? That is, the haves are doing pretty well and the have-nots are still struggling then?
Yeah, and you know, I think that's, you know, a good illustration of it. You know, we talk about 42% of households with income less now than it was pre-pandemic. I mean, that's illustrative of the lower leg of the K, where it's, you know, things are getting more difficult. And we see a rising level of pessimism among those consumers. More than half of them say it's going to take at least 6 months, if not more, for their income to rebound. That's higher than when we surveyed this back in June. It was 37% then. And, you know, I mentioned the percentage of households that say that they're worried about their income falling in the months ahead. That, too, is higher than it was in June. So some increasing pessimism creeping in as well.
Are they acquiring more debt in the process then?
Debt, running down savings, you know, I think those are the two things. You know, one of the things we saw when the economy first started to reopen in, you know, June, July, pretty robust consumer spending. People had some money to spend. They'd had stimulus payments. They'd padded the savings while they were locked down at home. You know, now that some of that stimulus has worn off, even, you know, things like unemployment compensation, not what it was a few months ago, you know, no surprise you're starting to see that softness in consumer spending, and you're starting to see those concerns about, gee, what am I going to do in the months ahead?
In this survey that you've done, can you break it down demographically?
Yeah, it really illustrates the fact that this pandemic, from a financial standpoint, has fallen hardest on younger workers as well as lower income workers. You know, of course, a lot of the service industries that, you know, tend to be lower paying or tend to be, you know, people just starting out their careers. That's where we've seen the tightest pinch. The millennials and Gen Zers, 63% say that they've seen their income go down since the outbreak of the pandemic. Compare that to just 37% of baby boomers. And to hit the income, while the initial hit to income is pretty even across all income groups, what we've noticed is that it's coming back at much different rates. higher income households, 30% of them that had seen a decline in income say it's already come back. It's just 9% of those in the lowest earning households. And of course, many of those are those frontline service workers that are still seeing great restrictions on their ability to work.
Yeah, no kidding. And then we shut them down again. We're talking about a survey you all did the middle of November of this year, obviously. What else jumped out at you in terms of where people are money-wise?
Well, when we, you know, look at, you know, how did this hit to income materialize? You know, the leading cause, you know, no surprise, layoff or furlough. But, you know, right behind that was reduced hours. I think, you know, that's something that, you know, a lot of people that are working, they've had their, they're not getting the hours that they were before. You know, business might be running a skeleton crew. You know, they may have restrictions on, you know, how much volume they can do, how many people can be in the store, so to speak. And that translates into reduced hours, which, you know, then you see how the dominoes fall. That's reduced income and then reduced ability for people to spend. And, you know, I think, you know, the other concern there is, you know, we talked about people piling up debt and or running down savings. You know, that creates a hole that may be difficult to dig out of.
Greg, would a different round of stimulus, I want to say sooner, I think we're going to get stimulus 2.0, but it hasn't happened yet. I wonder if it had happened sooner, if that would have changed your results at all.
I have to think so, because again, when we look at, we, you know, have the luxury of being able to compare these results with back in June, and we have seen a clear deterioration in the numbers, the level of pessimism and the worries about how long it's going to take that income to bounce back. And yes, you know, stimulus kind of the, you know, one of the missing pieces of that puzzle for sure.
Is there any political overtone to this? This isn't about Trump versus Biden, is it?
No, I mean, what we found is that, you know, this is something that at least the initial hit to income fell, you know, widely across the population. Half of households had seen a decline in their income at some point since the outbreak of the pandemic. And, you know, it's coming back at a very slow pace. And that reaches people of all political persuasions and all walks of life.
It's funny, too, because when we talk about the economy recovering, one of the things we, you know, hope people will start doing is spending money again. And yet, I suppose everybody is holding on to their dollars as much as they can, even those that have it. That's my guess. Are you finding that those who have been able to retain their income are spending, or are they saving more?
Well, there's definitely a high level of concern. 75% of households that have not seen their incomes go down are worried that it will in the next few months because of the pandemic. Well, you know, when you have that level of concern, you know, people tend to clutch the pocketbook a little bit tighter. And longer term, I think the outlook is much brighter than it was a couple of months ago with the widespread availability of vaccines. I think by the time you get to the middle of next year, there's going to be a lot of pent-up demand, particularly among those consumers on the upper leg of the K-shaped recovery. But we got to get there first. And, you know, with the virus cases where it is right now, to shutting down various aspects of you know, business, you know, that, you know, we got a bumpy road ahead the next few months.
Yeah. I kiddingly and not kiddingly say I'm going to sound the all clear horn on July 18th at 11:45 a.m. That's my sort of over under where we'll all be able to breathe the bit of a sigh of relief. I don't know that that's my herd immunity date, but that's where I'll go to a ball game date. That's my target. July 18th, 11:45 in the morning.
We'll take it, right?
I mean, that sounds early to you, doesn't it? That sounds optimistic, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it, I mean, I just think it depends, right? I mean, there's also the comfort level, right? So it's at what point do people feel comfortable going back out? And that's one of the other things that we've seen is even those that they haven't seen a hit to their incomes, that doesn't mean they've got the warm and fuzzy feeling to go spend money. They're either concerned about a hit to their income or they're concerned about being out in public around other people. Yeah. That feeling has to wane before you get that, you know, big uptick in activity. It's going to be a while before we, you know, start packing 30,000, 40,000 fans into Wrigley Field.
Yeah, that's probably the wild card that's going to bite me in the butt on my prediction here. Greg McBride is with Bankrate.com. All right, Greg, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Wintrust Business Lunch continues on WGN. Michelle Reisdorf is with the Chicago Employment Agency, Robert Half. She's an employment expert and joins us on the Business Lunch. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having us.
I know you did a wish list of people in Chicago. What do they want from their jobs or their employers? What do Chicago employees hope for this year?
Yeah, so we interviewed 2,800 workers, and we found that they kind of put together a top five wish list, with year-end bonuses being very much at the top of the list for, you know, what they would like.
Boy, I wonder what percentage of them are going to get that. I'll bet it's less than 72%.
Probably, unfortunately, but, you know, definitely it goes a long way. And, you know, what we've said to companies is, if you can't come through with money, consider other non-monetary things, such as maybe extra vacation days or even some professional development.
What else did people ask for? Like, all right, if my first wish for Christmas is a bonus, what's number two on the list?
Number two on the list was a home office upgrade. As you can imagine, 7 out of 10 workers are working remote right now. And so 30% said a stipend would definitely improve their work from home setup, whether it be, you know, a desk or office supplies, a printer, or things like that.
Do businesses do that?
Yeah, actually, our company itself actually came through with two different stipends this year, one about mid-year and one again at end of year, as we moved our entire workforce remote. And even a lot of the clients that we work with that are bringing on temporaries in a remote workforce have offered stipends for, you know, such things as printer, paper, supplies, ink, et cetera, because they're realizing they have to use so much of more of that at home.
I suppose the company owns those things. Someday they'll come back. They're not yours to keep.
Could be possibly, absolutely. You know, we have put out quite a bit of loaner technology to our candidates, you know, instead of a stipend. And, yes, you know, when their assignments are over, we definitely need to get the equipment back.
Although it is kind of interesting, because say you've got 100 employees and 70% of them are working from home, so you don't want 70 printers.
when
you come back
not.
To the office, we're not going to, I don't know, we've already got printers at our desks. I don't know if they're picking them up and moving them, but I can see how there would be a duplication here. Maybe you are just gifting this to the employee as they work at home. Some of them are working more than 8 hours a day anyway, right?
Absolutely. We have definitely seen workloads increase and hours of the day, you know, increase. Flexibility has increased as well, and that definitely made the wish list items, you know, kind of what we call windowed work, which allows a flexible schedule so that, you know, people can help support their families at home, too, with a lot of school, you know, schooling being done at home.
Now, remember, we're not working at home. We're living at work these days.
That's a great way to put it. Well, I've not heard that one, but that is perfect.
What else is on the wish list, or what are employees jonesing for these days?
Yeah, 38% said that stretch assignments and career paths are still very important to them. You know, even being remote, they want to know what the potential is for their current role and, you know, what other things that they can do in their future. I know for myself personally, I did a year-end review with each and every one of my team members, you know, to talk about what went well this year, but also what they would like to take on next year. As you can imagine, a lot of companies did have to furlough or lay off employees, which does open up opportunities for employees in the new year. So it's a good time to sit down and make sure you do some career pathing with your employees as well.
We're talking to Michelle Reisdorf from Robert Half. So are bosses monitoring the employees, and what's happening on that front?
Well, you know, we have started to hear some companies that are looking into, you know, employee monitoring tools. I think the important thing is that companies that choose to do so are very transparent about it, because, you know, our survey results did say that about 33% are opposed to those tools, right? They want to feel like their employer trusts them. And so transparency, I think, is the key thing.
What's an employee monitoring tool? I don't even know what that is.
Well, just like the ability, you'll find like in a lot of customer service call centers, they monitor the number of calls they take, the length of time that they last, et cetera. So with everybody working remote, you know, putting in technology tools to see, you know, how many hours a day is someone spending online versus, you know, are they kind of intermittent in and out? You know, definitely with a flexible work schedule, that's very different from your standard 8 to 5 in the office.
Yeah. Well, that, I get that. And for some, I guess, jobs, it makes sense to count the calls or the widgets that you're cranking out. But isn't this also a thing that maybe employers pre-pandemic didn't care what your vacation time was or your hours a day as long as you got the work done? It was productivity, and that was the only metric. This sounds like the opposite of that in a way.
Well, I think a little bit of it is I think some managers have felt that they could monitor productivity easier when they're in the office with them versus 100% remote. You know, I know in our case with my employees, I feel like our productivity has gone up because we are definitely working longer days. And on top of that, you know, because we're short staffed, we haven't seen many of our employees take their scheduled time off. And so I'm strongly recommending that, especially now at the holidays, that they take advantage of that because, you know, I'm concerned about them being burnt out working from home, juggling families, you know, working a longer day, and then not using their planned time off.
And maybe bosses don't see that because we're not all in the same place. Maybe 9 months in, we've kind of forgotten that you still need to tap them on the shoulder, say good job, say take an hour or half a day off. I don't know what the, you know, things are that an employer can do, but don't let out of sight mean out of mind, because I think people really need some positivity coming down the pipe, you know?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think the connection piece continues to be more important than ever. A lot of companies are feeling like, you know, these online meetings are getting to be too much, but I find, you know, if we lessen them, we lose that personal touch to our employees on a remote basis. So you got to maintain them. You just might have to change them up and make them a little bit more fun and exciting.
In my job, I'll finish with this. I don't do online meetings that often. I sure don't do Zoom conference calls. Yesterday, I did 3 in a row. I was here late. When I burst into the door yesterday, I said to my wife, now I know how our daughter-in-law, who's on a lot of these during the day, I said, now I know how Nikki feels. That's not fun.
Yeah.
But a full day of Zoom meetings is a special kind of hell. At least it was for me yesterday. So
let's tend
to the well-being of our employees. Something to think about. Michelle, don't worry about me. I'm fine. But to the rest of you all, I salute your efforts. Michelle Reisdorf with Robert Half. Nice to talk to you, Michelle.
You too. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Home prices in Chicago are growing faster than most other big metro areas. Online real estate marketplace Zillow says the median price of homes sold in the Chicago area was about 14.8% higher compared to the same period in 2019. It's the largest price increase among the top 10 large metro areas in the country. Zillow says it's 1% above second place Phoenix, which saw a jump of 13.7%. The increases are good for sellers, but bad for home affordability. Boeing is expanding inspections of its 787 Dreamliners because of potential defects found in the plane's body. A spokesperson says the company is looking at spots where the surface of the fuselage isn't as smooth as it should be. That could create tiny gaps where fuselage sections connect, leading to structural fatigue. Federal regulators say this doesn't pose an immediate hazard, but it is slowing Boeing's deliveries of Dreamliners. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
WGN Radio News at the top of the hour. It's 12:52. Amy Guth joins us now. You want to start with the flexible work week from Google? What's going on there, Amy?
Yeah, I thought this was very interesting and very of the moment, and that is that Google has announced that in terms of employees returning to the office, they're moving that date back. They had originally said summer of 2021. Now they're saying September of 2021. And this all comes from an email sent out by the CEO on Sunday night. They said that they're going to test out a flexible work week. That means working at least 3 days a week in the office and then the other days at home. You know, we're seeing this. Google's kind of the latest to do this. We saw Microsoft announced something similar. Facebook said in May that they would have maybe half of the workers working remotely over the next decade. Twitter said it would offer a permanent work-from-home option. And then just today we learned that Facebook is looking to unload one of its Chicago spaces. So I think what we're seeing is the result of a lot of companies kind of reassessing, what does it mean to be a company? Do we really need all the physical space that we thought that we did? Do people even want to be here? Do they kind of like working from home? And how do we accommodate people, you know, different needs and different preferences? So, you know, I think for Google, what a huge company, that'll be a really interesting experiment to see that prolonged working from home status coming from them that will probably inspire a lot of other companies to kind of examine what their needs are for space and for workers, too.
Speaking of rolling things back, I just want to reiterate the points that Steve Alexander made a moment ago, that while it's not passed, the bill the Congress is considering would have funds for forbearance. Your student loan payments would not be due for another 3 months, go from not only the end of January to, I think he said, the end of April. Hasn't passed, but it's interesting, even as the vaccine rolls out, how things are still a little delayed on the recovery side. You know, another interesting story to me was the pot business in Chicago. And I know that's kind of on your radar, too. What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's very interesting how, you know, although illegal federally still, so we're not really seeing that on, you know, securities exchanges here, we are seeing it in Canada. And three of the big eight marijuana companies that are growers or retailers are based here in Chicago. So Verano Holdings has just announced that they're going to go public on the Canadian Stock Exchange. They're going to do that through a reverse takeover of an existing public company. They're hoping to raise about $75 million by doing that. That's according to an investor presentation. And you know, so we're seeing these companies that have gone public on the Canadian Stock Exchange. We'll see, you know, what the timeline is for when and if that happens here in the U.S. But for now, we're seeing these companies going public. And as I said, of these big eight, we've got three of them headquartered here. So we're starting to see more and more eyes kind of looking to Chicago. And, of course, Illinois is such a big agricultural state. We're looking more and more like we're shaping up to be kind of this hub for this marijuana industry, which I think will be very interesting to kind of keep an eye on. What's interesting about Verano Holdings, though, that I think is also worth noting, there was a sale that there was a company that was going to buy them a while ago. And that sale, if it had gone through, that was called Harvest Health and Recreation, what Verano expects to raise by going public will be about three times more. It will be about, the deal will be worth about $2.9 billion. That's about three times more than what they would have gotten had that sale gone through. So it's kind of a, you know, blessing in disguise sort of thing. There was a lot of shock when that deal didn't go through, when that didn't happen. There was a lot of press leading up to it. The Harvest CEO was kind of talking about it quite a lot. So when that fell apart, I think there were a lot of questions there. So by going public, that makes them a far more valuable company. But I think it's very interesting how Chicago has really taken the lead in that area, in that sector of business.
Speaking of Chicago headquarters, Boeing here has announced that the Dreamliner inspections were not perfect. Huh?
Yeah, and we heard a little of this just a bit ago from Steve Grzanich in the news brief, but essentially, you know, it's another shoe to drop for Chicago-based Boeing. There is a defect that has been, it's a manufacturing defect that could prematurely age the carbon fiber frames of the aircraft. So Boeing did not deliver any 787s last month. Leadership has gone out and said, you know, part of this is about these increasing times for quality controls, increasing time for inspection, things like that. But, you know, after all that Boeing has been through for the last 20 months, you know, even pandemic aside, all the issues that were raised by whistleblowers and FAA investigations in terms of how their planes were certified, I think for another thing to happen really does kind of raise some questions about their quality controls. Are they really there yet? As they've spent, you know, the last year, certainly the last 6 months, really ramping up and really talking more about their quality control process and their inspection process and how that's going to go. For something to come up that is, you know, in the manufacturing process that cast doubt, I think is not helpful to Boeing. Should be noted, it's not an immediate hazard. It just helps it would just kind of speed the aging process of the plane's body, of the plane's frame.
Ah.
So it's not an immediate process, but they are going to immediately start inspecting planes that they haven't yet delivered, planes that are still in production, and figure out how to assess the planes that have are that are already in the air.
And last point, I'm glad you made that. Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.